Okay, I've been studying the book of Daniel, as you know. And we're ready for chapter 5, so we're going to get right into that. Turn there, if you would, please. Daniel chapter 5. First thing I want to point out, notice, is the change from chapter 4 to chapter 5. The last verse of chapter 4 speaks about King Nebuchadnezzar, and it's the last you will read about him. And he, being the powerful man in the world that he was, made this statement. Verse 37 of chapter 4, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways are judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. So that statement was made by him. And I want you to notice the abrupt change in the mood and the new character that comes on the scene in chapter 5. A little introduction would be, who is the new king that it talks about? Belshazzar the king. So in the past, there have been critics that say that King Belshazzar is not one of in the list. If you look in history, he's not on the list as one of the kings of Babylon, I believe, until more recently. Actually, he's still probably not on the list, and critics try to disprove Daniel's credibility with that. One of the things they try to disprove the word of God. See, Daniel was not credible because King Belshazzar was not even king of Babylon. So I did a little research on that, and the reason they used is because the only place he's mentioned was in the Bible, in Daniel, in this chapter, and maybe one obscure other place somewhere. And so they said he was not the king. And in this, another thing they would use in this chapter, five times it says Nebuchadnezzar calls him he calls Nebuchadnezzar my father, or Nebuchadnezzar calls him his son. And so if you do a study, if you look, did Nebuchadnezzar have a son named Belshazzar? Well, no, he did not. And so they would use that also. And so what about that? And so the father-son relationship used five times in this chapter. The NIV note on that, after it says father here in the first verse 2, I believe, which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out, says ancestor or predecessor. So you could say, well, it was a poetic way of saying somebody that was before you, the father of, you know, you hear the terms, the father of aviation or the father of this. So that was their way of saying, and he was probably an ancestor, but he wasn't directly a father. And so another example that I thought of was, and it's something that happened to me fairly recently, was, I'll just tell you this little story. We were at Huntington Prison, and the chaplain came out to meet us the first day. Some of you that were there know. And Mark was there. And Mark noticed, the gentleman was a foreign guy, and he had a foreign accent. And Mark noticed pretty quickly that he was carrying a Quran. And so, and I'm saying this to make the point about the father. So he was a Muslim imam, and he sat in on our services. He was a chaplain at Huntington State Prison. And so I think we prayed for him a time or so, like in our group prayer, that not only were we ministering to inmates, that he would maybe see the truth too. And I believe it was Saturday, we had lunch in the in the staff cafeteria, and he had lunch with us. So we ate out. Some of us ate outside in like a little courtyard. I came back in, and I thought, if I get a chance to talk to him, I will. Didn't know exactly what I was going to say, so went in there, and he was sitting at a table by himself, and I sat down with him and exchanged a few formalities like we do. And then he actually started the conversation. There was a TV going, and I don't want to make my story too long, but there was a lady preaching on there, and she wasn't, well, she was a little obnoxious maybe. And so he right away said, what denomination is she? He asked me. And later I thought of it. You know why he said that is because in listening to Nabil Qureshi, the Muslim who became a Christian, I found out that that Muslims do not think very much of Christianity because they come over here to the Western world, and everything that goes down in the name of Christianity is, well, we know it's not all good, and say that they would use that against Christianity. So when he said to me, what denomination is she? He was trying to pick, you know, right away on Christianity. I said I didn't know, and, you know, we went on and actually had a conversation. Actually, I played dumb and said, what denomination are you? And then he hesitated for a little bit, and he didn't want to really say it. And all of a sudden he said, well, I'm Muslim. And I said, okay. And so I asked him some things about his faith. I asked him about Jesus, you know, how do you view Jesus? Who's Jesus? Anyhow, he said, this is where I'm getting to the part about the Father. He said, Jesus and Muhammad are the same thing. They're good prophets. And then I said, so I asked him who Jesus' father was, who he thought Jesus' father was. And I don't know if he was, I mean, he had a lot of, if you ever talk to a Muslim, which I didn't really expect to talk to a Muslim. And so I probably wasn't as prepared as I should be. But I think I breathed the prayer and asked God for help. And God might have gave me that word. Who was Jesus' father? Well, he hesitated a while. He didn't really know what to say. So I asked him if he thought it was Joseph. And he said, no, it wasn't Joseph. And so he obviously couldn't say it was God because he didn't believe that God was Jesus' father. So he kind of went around and said, well, the Quran says his mother was Maria. Instead of answering the question about the father, he answered the question about the mother. So that was his. And I said, well, I believe that Jesus was the Son of God and that God was his father. And he said, well, where do you get that? And I said, well, I thought for a while in the Bible, when Jesus walked on the earth all through the New Testament, Jesus refers to God as his father. And so I told him that, and he said, well, that's not literally, that's figuratively. Where I'm coming to this. And that's actually what they would do sometimes in the Old Testament. They would refer to their father as, it was figuratively, as in this chapter, five different times. And so that was his disproof of that. It was, but he never could really answer who Jesus' father was, but he did know who his mother was. And so here, Nebuchadnezzar was not the father of Belshazzar. And by the way, I had a good conversation, and it really inspired me to witness to Muslims, because I think they have a lot of, there's a lot of strong points. I know they're way off, but they have strong families. They have, believe it or not, they have a lot of things in common with us. I'm not saying, yeah, we're worlds apart, but they believe in some of the same things. So if you can get them to become Christians, I think they're strong Christians and strong people for the Lord. Okay, we're going on. And then in, you know, Jeremiah, I think you might have mentioned archaeology. I think it was the mid-1800s, then someone discovered this thing they called the Nabonidus cylinder. And Nabonidus, if I'm saying that right, was actually the king at this time. So he would have been the king, and this Belshazzar would have been his son. They found out from reading that old thing that they found. And so basically proved what the Bible said was true. But the thing about him is that he would roam all over other parts of the country and not really stay there in Babylon. And there was maybe reports that he was a little bit mentally unstable, or he liked to travel. I don't know if they really know, but at any rate, Belshazzar was the, I don't know if they would have called him the king back then, but he was a co-regent under the king. And so Daniel calls him king and lets the other name out, maybe for the sake of just clarity and not having to explain all that. So basically it's proven that he is an actual person. This is not a made up account. But I'm going to read verses 1 to 4 at this time. Belshazzar the king made a great feast to 1,000 of his lords and drank wine before the 1,000. Belshazzar, while he tasted the wine, commanded to bring the golden and silver vessels which his father Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem, that the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines might drink therein. Then they brought the golden vessels that were taken out of the temple of the house of God, which was at Jerusalem. And the king and his princes, his wives and his concubines drank in them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and of silver, of brass, of iron, of wood, and of stone. Okay, we'll stop there. I kind of broke this into sections. This first one, I just put little titles to give me a idea what happened there. The Great Feast, basically, is what. So I want you to notice, first of all, the size of the party that he gave. 1,000 of his lords. And later it says his wives and his concubines were there. And so I don't know if all the wives of the lords were there and all the concubines are not. Doesn't say that, but I would guess that could be the case. We don't know, but 1,000 people with just the lords and probably twice that many. And so they were feasting, drinking, and praising their gods. And so if you can imagine that in a big hall, all these people, you can imagine the noise. And somewhere along the line, Belshazzar got the idea that, you know what, we have these sacred vessels, cups of gold and silver, that we could drink wine out of these. You know, he might have been starting to, you get, I don't know, it doesn't say anywhere that they were drunk, but I don't know, I'm going to kind of read that in. But when you have a big party and you're feasting and you're drinking wine, there's a good chance that you just might get drunk. So he had this idea, and I don't think God was smiling down on him at that point, that, hey, let's get these cups. He might have just remembered back in the good old glory days when Babylon was the world power. Because right now, the enemy, according to history, if you read, the enemy was camped basically outside their walls, and their walls were so high and big that there was really no chance. I think they had a double wall. If the enemy would have climbed the first wall, he would have been caught in the middle. There was no chance of them getting in, but they were out there. And as they partied, the enemy was outside the wall. So keep that in mind. Now we'll read verse praising their gods. So they were drinking wine, praising the gods, and so it was probably quite a roar in that place if they were all getting drunk. So writing on the wall, verses 5 to 9, in the same hour came forth fingers of a man's hand and wrote over against the candlestick upon the plaster of the wall of the king's palace, and the king saw the part of the hand that wrote. Then the king's countenance was changed, and his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his loins were loosed, and his knees smote one against another. The king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, and the soothsayers. And the king spake and said to the wise men of Babylon, whosoever shall read this writing and shall show me the interpretation thereof shall be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about his neck and shall be the third ruler in the kingdom. Then came in all the king's wise men, but they could not read the writing nor make known to the king the interpretation thereof. Then was King Belshazzar greatly troubled, and his countenance was changed in him, and his lords were astonished. Okay, we have that account. And this, you know, this the saying, the writing on the wall, is still a saying that we use today, or the handwriting on the wall, or whatever. It's used in books, literature, for titles. It's used in music. It's still used today. And so I mentioned the noise level. You know, you think back of our, sometimes our fellowship meals in the basement. We have what? We have 100+ people here. And I don't think that there was maybe no children at their party, but you know how loud it can get sometimes just with 100+ people. And and we're not drinking wine and getting drunk and praising our gods. We should be praising our God. But in other words, I'm trying to make the point that it was very loud. And you know, God could have called much louder to get their attention. God could have called down in a booming voice and said, hey, all you sinners down there, you know, and got their attention. But it would just been more noise. Okay, they were used to noise. So it was interesting to me what God did. He did the opposite of that. He did something that made no sound at all. So if you ever thought of that, and the amount of, or the way that he got their attention by doing something that made no sound at all was amazing. And so if you notice in verse 6 and 7, the fear that came upon the king, and I don't know if you ever tried to scare a drunk man, but I don't, they're pretty relaxed, and I don't think they take a lot too seriously. So it was kind of amazing to me that he was able to put this kind of fear in this man by just a handwriting on the wall instead of King Belshazzar just laughing it off, or, hey, look at that, you know. So it was from God, and the fear was there. And here again in verse 9, it says about his fear, he was greatly troubled. He was so troubled, his countenance changed. He might have looked white as a sheet, and his lords were astonished. You know, they were astonished at how much fear he had, or else they were astonished at what he was astonished at. So, okay, again, the king was, you know, the king was very agitated. And the scene in verses 7 or 8 where he calls everybody out and says, interpret this for me. We looked at the book of Daniel already, and it's familiar. It's happened numerous times before, so nobody could interpret it. So let's read on in verse 10. Now the queen, by reason of the words of the king and his lords, came into the banquet house. And the queen spake and said, O king, live forever. Let not thy thoughts trouble thee, nor let thy countenance be changed. There is a man in thy kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, and in the days of thy father, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him, whom the king Nebuchadnezzar, thy father, there's that reference, the king, I say, thy father made master of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Forasmuch as an excellent spirit and knowledge and understanding, interpreting of dreams and showing of hard sentences and dissolving of doubts were found in the same Daniel whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now let Daniel be called, and he will show the interpretation. Then was Daniel brought in before the king, and the king spake and said unto Daniel, art thou that Daniel which art of the children of the captivity of Judah, whom the king, my father, brought out of Jewry? I have even heard of thee, that the spirit of the gods is in thee, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom is found in thee. And now the wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known unto me the interpretation thereof. But they could not show the interpretation of the thing. And I have heard of thee, that thou canst make interpretations and dissolve doubts. Now, if thou canst read the writing and make known to me the interpretation thereof, thou shalt be clothed with scarlet and have a chain of gold about thy neck and shalt be the third ruler in the kingdom. So moving back, the queen came on the scene, and here you could say, who was this queen? Was this his wife or not? And we don't really know, but some of the clues would be in verse 2, where it says his wives and concubines were with him in this party, says in verse 2. And then in verse 10, it says the queen came, by reason of the king, came into the banquet house. So either she went out, or she wasn't one of the, and came back in, or she wasn't one of the ones. I would almost tend to think that she was one of the former king's wives, such as Nebuchadnezzar or one of the other kings. There was actually a couple kings in between Nebuchadnezzar and Belshazzar, and Nabonidus, who was the actual king at this time. So one clue would be the way she remembered the past way better than he did would suggest that maybe she was older than him. And she knew of Daniel, and he seemed to know nothing of him. And then I want you to notice verses 11, 12, and 14, the reputation of Daniel, basically, that he had a reputation in their culture. And that's why I think maybe she was older. She knew the reputation of Daniel. And so in verse 11, there's a couple things. Light and understanding and wisdom was found in him. In verse 12, he had an excellent spirit, knowledge, and understanding. And this was somebody that, you know, a pagan queen that didn't worship the true God that was saying this about him. This is his reputation, his testimony of that culture, that people. And then in verse 12, or did I say that? He was known to have, yeah, an excellent spirit. He could interpret dreams and all of that. And then in verse 14, light and understanding and excellent wisdom was found in him. And so he had that reputation with those people, and she remembered it. And then right there in verse 16, the third ruler would also be a clue that would point to the actual king being Nabonidus. If you look in history, that's who the king was. Belshazzar, his son, being somewhat king under him, would be number two. And then whoever interprets the dream would be the third ruler in the kingdom. And that fits with that. So Daniel would be the third ruler if he would interpret the dream. So reading verse 17, then Daniel answered and said before the king, let thy gifts be to thyself and give thy rewards to another. Yet I will read the writing unto the king and make known to him the interpretation. O thou king, the most high God gave Nebuchadnezzar thy father a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And for the majesty that he gave him, all people, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whom he would he slew, and whom he would he kept alive, and whom he would set up, whom he would he set up, and whom he would he put down. He did whatever he wanted to. This was Nebuchadnezzar. But when his heart was lifted up and his mind hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. And he was driven from the sons of men, and his heart was made like the beasts, and his dwelling was with the wild asses. They fed him with grass like oxen, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven, till he knew that the Most High God ruled in the kingdom of men, and that he appointeth over it whomsoever he will. And maybe I'll just stop there for a minute. Verse 17, you know, Daniel was not, he was not in it. He was not a prophet of God for the money, for the profit, if you will. He was not a prophet for the profit. He was not a greedy person. And so he didn't want, he wasn't too worried about the money. He wasn't thinking, hey, if I could answer this, I would be rich and I would be a ruler. I'd be famous. He said, keep your money. The verses we read, 18 to 21, Belshazzar, Daniel gives Belshazzar the recent history of his quote unquote father. And he would have known it. I think if I'm right, Nebuchadnezzar would have died 23 years before that Belshazzar was killed, or this event right here. He would have been 23 years ago, I think, if I have that right. And so it would have been something that he remembered fairly recent history. He didn't, but Daniel gives this to him. He's setting him up, say, as Nebuchadnezzar, his father, as an example to him. And then in verse 22, 23, Daniel begins to bring down the hammer, so to speak, on him, telling him, you know, what he did wrong. And I'll read that. 20. And so look at it. And I want to outline this verse a little bit. We'll read, I'll read the whole way to 29 maybe, or 28. And thou, his son, O Belshazzar, hast not humbled thine heart, though thou knewest all this. And so that's actually one of that phrase I'd like to pull out of there. So keep it in mind, though thou knewest all this. And so it was recent history. He knew it, but Daniel went over it just for the fact to set Nebuchadnezzar up as an example to him. Look what happened. Okay, but thou hast lifted up thyself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before thee, and thou and thy lords, thy wives and thy concubines have drunk wine in them. And thou hast praised the gods of silver and gold, of brass, iron, wood, and stone, which see not, nor hear, nor know, and the God in whose hand thy breath is, and whose are all thy ways, hast thou not glorified. Then was the part of the hand sent from him, and this was the writing. And I'll actually stop there. So so he's saying 25, 23 short years ago, there was a man who was doing some of the exact same things you're doing, the very same things. And here is what happened to him. And then the phrase that I want to look at, and though you knew all this, and though you knew all this, you knew your recent history, you still would not humble yourself. And that quote was made this morning. I actually have that quote written down. Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. That was the original quote. And then I think Winston Churchill quoted a version of that somewhat similar, but those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. And there's another quote I want you to get. I like this quote by Machiavelli, a philosopher. Whoever, and listen to this, whoever wishes to foresee the future, and this is with the phrase, and though you knew all this, you would not humble yourself. Whoever wishes to foresee the future must consult the past. For human events ever resemble those of preceding times. And then he gives why. Okay, why do human events resemble those of preceding times? This arises from the fact that they are produced by men who have been and ever shall be animated by the same passions, and thus they necessarily have the same results. I like that quote with that phrase, though you knew all this. Romans 15:4, for everything that was written in the past was written to teach us. 1 Corinthians 10:11, these things happened to them, speaking of the children of Israel, as examples, and they were written down for our learning. And so, you know, did you ever say to one of your friends or one of your children or whoever, you watched them do something and you said, you know, didn't you know that was going to happen? You know, I could see it coming. You know, I have five children. And so sometimes I have to say, you know, couldn't you just see that that's what was going to happen? When you did this, that's what was going to happen. It was just the way it is. But, you know, sometimes humans, we don't learn from the mistakes of others. We think we need to try this ourselves. And there's probably, you know, I'm just a little different. I don't think the results aren't going to happen to me that happened to him. I'm just a little bit more clever than he was. Well, guess what? We are animated by the same passions, therefore produces the same results. And so keep that in mind. It seems that humans do not learn from the mistakes of others. Outline of verse 23. I might put this on the board, just a couple words. He gives four things why Nebuchadnezzar, his sins basically, and why he was going to be judged. And it's interesting that he didn't tell him to turn from his sins and repent, because and God was going to be there to pardon him. He didn't say anything of that. But he did tell him what he did wrong. Like Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel implored him to turn from his ways. Not so with this man. So number one would be, you set yourself up against the God of heaven. That's a little bit of a paraphrase for the first one. And so what would you call that? Setting yourself up against the God of heaven. Somebody give me a one word. What is that? Pride. Okay, that is, you know, we studied Daniel up to this point, and that's one of the main themes of the book of Daniel, is pride and the effects of pride and where pride will take you. And so he comes again in this chapter. So I'm just going to write, actually, if I can get this up a little. I'm just going to write, it's four things. Number one being, that's not the right, well, just go like this. Pride. And so a good definition of pride is right in this verse. Thou hast lifted up thyself against the God, the Lord of heaven. You set yourself up against the God of heaven. And as we look in our own hearts, you know, we can look in our society really easy. And the laws that are being passed and the things that are coming down the pike, our society is lifting itself up against the God of heaven. James mentioned the atheist big rally or whatever it is. But I think we got to do more than look out there. If I think every one of us can see pride or places in our life, in our hearts, where pride wants to manifest itself. It's one of the biggest sins. And it's what Satan was threw out of heaven for. And number two is, you brought the vessels from God's temple and drank wine in them at your pagan party. Basically. And so, what would you call that? Any ideas? One word. This might be a little more difficult. I just kind of took these sentences and wrote them out and thought of a word that described it. So you might not think of the same word I thought of. Yep, that's true. I thought of the word sacrilege, and maybe that's not a word that, you know, I use the word occasionally, sacrilegious, but sacrilege, well, I'll write it down. But it is, It comes from, see if I have room here. Well, I'm not going to, let's go like this. This is Latin for, you see that? Holy, sacred, this, and then the last part of the word means to gather or steal. So it is, and then there's a Latin word called basically sacrilegious, not quite spelled how we spell it, and it means basically holy. Well, this would be holy robber. Basically, the Latin word sacrilegious means temple robber or temple defiler, or one who steals sacred property. So they were taking God's sacred vessels dedicated to the temple, and they were using them in a way that desecrated them, and that is sacrilegious. And if you look at our, normally what I think is sacrilegious now is making a joke of holy things. That's where I would use the word sacrilegious. And our country does a lot of that. We do. I would say every one of us borders on it occasionally. So I would want to watch that, you know, in jokes, in different things that can be sacrilegious, taking something, robbing God, taking something sacred and robbing God of the glory he deserves, or making a mockery of it. Temple defiler. And so in the Old Testament, there are examples of this. Wicked Queen Athaliah, she had two sons, and they would take the sacred objects out of the temple and they would use them to worship Baal. And do you think that God was too happy about that? No, he wasn't. And so that's what they were doing here. They were saying, hey, and probably in their drunken state, let's get these nice cups and let's drink wine out of these to our gods. And they were to be used, if you study the temple and the objects in the temple, they were to be used for these specific things. Another example would be Aaron's sons, Eli's sons. They were priests in the temple, and they did horrendous things under the name of temple worship or temple duty. And so that's sacrilegious. So we'll put that for number two. You brought the vessels. And these, remember, these are sins. These are things why he is being judged. So pride, sacrilege. And number three, you worship gods that cannot hear or understand. And so what would that be? One of the children tell me what that is when you worship a god that cannot hear or understand. Aaron. Idols, and that would be called idolatry. You're right. And so James has been talking about this, so we'll put that for number three. Idolatry. And we all know what that is. The first commandment God gave his people was, thou shalt have no other gods before me. Is there our idolatry in our country today? Is there idolatry in our church? How about in our hearts? Think about that. Music artists, sports heroes, movie actors. You know, our country is just, it's all about the latest idol, basically. And number four, you did not honor the one true God who holds your life in his hands. That's the fourth and last sin. And I'm just going to call that, you did not honor the one true God. I'm just going to say dishonor. And so as you look at these four things, are we, or people in the United States of America, is that a problem for us? This is what Belshazzar was judged for, and what he ended up at the end of this chapter being killed for. This is what Daniel said from God. This is what you did. And you had an example, and though you knew all this, you had an example in your predecessor, in Nebuchadnezzar. He gives out an overview of his life, and he hits the high points of his life, and he says, you knew all this, but you went ahead and did the same thing. So I think he's telling us we need to look and learn from the mistakes of others. Jesus said, these people honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. That's dishonor. In Acts 17, 27 and 28, Paul said of the one true God, and he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. For in him we live and move and have our being. We are his offspring. So God is in control of your life, and he's saying you didn't give him honor. So we need to honor him. Honor God. You could go into that. What does it mean to honor God? But we're going to keep moving. I didn't realize it was getting this late. So there are four reasons Daniel gave to the king as to why he was being judged. These four. And you know, there's many people today that think the writing is on the wall for our country, for the United States of America, because of, and if you match it up to this story, because we're so guilty of the very same thing. And, you know, the term the writing on the wall has a connotation of impending doom. And so a little bit of history then. The city was besieged by the army of King Cyrus. So he was a Persian, I believe. Darius was a Mede. The Medes and Persian. And they were outside the city. The Euphrates River ran right through the city of Babylon. So they were outside the city, and they devised a plan to dig trenches and have the water run out of the Euphrates River. And it even seems like they knew that this party was going on. And while they were partying, excuse me, my voice gets so dry. While they were partying, the enemy was outside the wall, draining the river. And once they got the water to a level where they could walk, they walked right through the gates that they could have pulled down to keep. They had gates in the river, it sounded like. But they had them open, and they walked right in on the riverbed. And, you know, I thought of that for our country. You know, humans were animated by the same passions, and so we still do that. They saw the army outside the wall, camped outside the wall. They, in order to forget their troubles and their problems, they decided to throw a huge party and get drunk and do whatever else they wanted to do. And, you know, the effects of drugs and alcohol on our society today is sort of the same thing. People say, I don't want to face reality. I know that my life is a mess, in shambles. And so I'm going to do drugs, alcohol, to make me forget. And that's have a good time. And so humans are still the same as they were back then. And I'll skip over. I'll close on a positive note. Never underestimate the influence of a godly example or life on your community, on your society. So you think, what am I doing that ever amounts to anything? Never underestimate the influence of a godly life. Daniel had a reputation. Remember I talked about that? For truth, for honesty, for wisdom, for understanding. And he had an excellent spirit. And so that reputation among those ungodly people, that's what they remembered him for. And when they ran into problems, they needed him. They went to him. And can you imagine that in our day? The leader of a country and a man of God speaking that straight to him. And when he was done, instead of cutting off his head, he rewarded him. He gave him these things and promoted him to ruler. You know, he just said some pretty powerful things against him. So what do we want to remember this morning? Though you knew all this, yet you did not humble yourself. So as we observe the past, the successes and failures in our lives, in my life, in families, maybe families we know, our family, the successes and failures in churches, our church, though you knew all this, you did not humble yourselves. Let's ask ourselves why. Why do you take lessons from the past? You know, I think you can have evil men and good men. You can study the past, study the evil men, study the good men, and you can take lessons and you figure out, you know, I don't want to go this way or I do want to go this way for what makes a successful family or a successful church. What are some steps that we can take that 25 years down the road, we'll still be faithful to God? Let us learn from history so we do not repeat our failures over and over. And once again, never underestimate the power or the influence of a godly life in your community. So thank you.